Chapter 7. We contrived to keep afloat all that night, and, the stream running strong with us, to glide a long way down the river. But, we found the night to be a dangerous time for such navigation, on account of the eddies and rapids, and it was therefore settled next day that in future we would bring to at sunset, and encamp on the shore. As we knew of no boats that the pirates possessed up at the prison in the woods, we settled always to encamp on the opposite side of the stream, so as to have the breadth of the river between our sleep and them. Our opinion was that if they were acquainted with any near way by land to the mouth of this river, they would come up it in force, and retake us or kill us, according as they could. But that if that was not the case, and if the river ran by none of their secret stations, we might escape. When I say we settled this or that, I do not mean that we planned anything with any confidence as to what might happen an hour hence. So much had happened in one night, and such great changes had been violently and suddenly made in the fortunes of many among us, that we had got better used to uncertainty, in a little while, than I dare say most people do in the course of their lives. The difficulties we soon got into, through the offsettings and point currents of the stream, made the likelihood of our being drowned, alone, to say nothing of our being retaken, as broad and plain as the sun at noonday to all of us. But we all worked hard at managing the rafts, under the direction of the seamen of our own skill. I think we never could have prevented them from oversetting, and we also worked hard at making good the defects in their first hasty construction which the water soon found out. While we humbly resigned ourselves to going down, if it was the will of our Father that was in heaven, we humbly made up our minds that we would all do the best that was in us. And so we held on, gliding with the stream. It drove us to this bank, and it drove us to that bank, and it turned us, and whirled us, but yet it carried us on. Sometimes much too slowly, sometimes much too fast, but yet it carried us on. My little deaf and dumb boy slumbered a good deal now, and that was the case with all the children. They caused very little trouble to anyone. They seemed, in my eyes, to get more like one another, not only in quiet manner, but in the face too. The motion of the raft was usually so much the same, the scene was usually so much the same, the sound of the soft wash and ripple of the water was usually so much the same, that they were made drowsy, as they might have been by the constant playing of one tune. Even on the grown people, who worked hard and felt anxiety, the same things produced something of the same effect. Every day was so like the other, that I soon lost count of the days, myself, and had to ask Miss Marion, for instance, whether this was the third or fourth. Miss Marion had a pocketbook and pencil, and she kept the log. That is to say, she entered up a clear little journal of the time, and of the distances our seamen thought we had made, each night. So, as I say, we kept afloat and glided on. All day long, and every day, the water, and the woods, and sky, all day long, and every day, the constant watching of both sides of the river, and far ahead at every bold turn, and sweep it made, for any signs of pirate boats, or pirate dwellings. So, as I say, we kept afloat and glided on. The days melting themselves together to that degree, that I could hardly believe my ears, when I asked how many now, miss? And she answered seven. To be sure, poor Mr. Portage had, by about now, got his diplomatic coat into such a state as never was seen. What with the mud of the river, what with the water of the river, what with the sun, and the dews, and the tearing boughs, and the thickets, it hung about him in discolored shreds like a mop. The sun had touched him a bit. He had taken to always polishing one particular button, which just held onto his left wrist, and to always calling for stationery. I suppose that man called for pens, ink, and paper, tape, and scaling wax, upwards of 1,000 times in 24 hours. He had an idea that we should never get out of that river unless we were written out of it in a formal memorandum, and the more we labored at navigating the rafts, the more he ordered us not to touch them at our peril, and the more he sat and roared for stationery. Mrs. Portage, similarly, persisted in wearing her nightcap. I doubt if anyone but ourselves who had seen the progress of that article of dress could by this time have told what it was meant for. It had got so limp and ragged that she couldn't see out of her eyes for it. It was so dirty that whether it was vegetable matter out of a swamp, or weeds out of the river, or an old porter's nut from England, I don't think any new spectator could have said. Yet, this unfortunate old woman had a notion that it was not only vastly genteel, but that it was the correct thing as to propriety. And she really did carry herself over the other ladies who had no nightcaps, and who were forced to tie up their hair how they could, in a superior manner that was perfectly amazing. I don't know what she looked like, sitting in that blessed nightcap, on a log of wood, outside the other cabin upon our raft. She would have rather resembled a fortune teller in one of the picture books that used to be in the shop windows in my boyhood, except for her stateliness. But, Lord bless my heart, the dignity with which she sat and moped, with her head in that bundle of tatters, was like nothing else in the world. She was not on speaking terms with more than three of the ladies. Some of them had, what she called, taken precedence of her in getting into, or out of, that miserable little shelter, and others had not called to pay their respects, or something of that kind. So, there she sat, in her own state and ceremony, while her husband sat on the same log of wood, ordering us one and all to let the raft go to the bottom, and to bring him stationary. What with this noise on the part of Mr. Commissioner Portage, and what with the cries of Sergeant Druce on the raft astern, which were sometimes more than Tom Packer could silence, we often made our slow way down the river, anything but quietly. Yet, that it was of great importance that no ears should be able to hear us from the woods on the banks, could not be doubted. We were looked for, to a certainty, and we might be retaken at any moment. It was an anxious time. It was, indeed, an anxious time. On the seventh night of our voyage on the rafts, we made fast, as usual, on the opposite side of the river to that from which we had started, in as dark a place as we could pick out. Our little encampment was soon made, and supper was eaten, and the children fell asleep. The watch was set, and everything made orderly for the night. Such a starlight night, with such blue in the sky, and such black in the places of heavy shade on the banks of the great stream. Those two ladies, Miss Marion and Mrs. Fisher, had always kept near me since the night of the attack. Mr. Fisher, who was untiring in the work of our raft, had said to me, "My dear little childless wife has grown so attached to you, Davis, and you are such a gentle fellow, as well as such a determined one." Our party had adopted that last expression from the one-eyed English pirate, and I repeat what Mr. Fisher said, only because he said it, that it takes a load off my mind to leave her in your charge. I said to him, "Your lady is in far better charge than mine, sir, having Miss Marion to take care of her, but you may rely upon it that I will guard them both faithful and true." Says he, "I do rely upon it, Davis, and I heartily wish all the silver on our old island was yours." That seventh starlight night, as I have said, we made our camp, and got our supper, and set our watch, and the children fell asleep. It was solemn and beautiful in those wild and solitary parts, to see them, every night before they lay down, kneeling under the bright sky, saying their little prayers at women's laps. At that time we men all uncovered, and mostly kept at a distance. When the innocent creatures rose up, we murmured amen, all together. For, though we had not heard what they said, we know it must be good for us. At that time too, as was only natural, those poor mothers in our company, whose children had been killed, shed many tears. I thought the sight seemed to console them, while it made them cry. But, whether I was right or wrong in that, they wept very much. On this seventh night, Mrs. Fisher had cried for her lost darling until she cried herself asleep. She was lying on a little couch of leaves, and such like I made the best little couch I could for them every night, and Miss Marion had covered her, and sat by her, holding her hand. The stars looked down upon them. As for me, I guarded them. Davis, says Miss Marion. I am not going to say what a voice she had. I couldn't if I tried. I am here, miss. The river sounds as if it were swollen tonight. We all think, miss, that we are coming near the sea. Do you believe now we shall escape? I do now, miss, really believe it. I had always said I did, but I had in my own mind been doubtful. How glad you will be, my good Davis, to see England again. I have another confession to make that will appear singular. When she said these words, something rose in my throat, and the stars I looked away at seemed to break into sparkles that fell down my face and burned it. England is not much to me, miss, except as a name. Oh, so true an Englishman should not say that. Are you not well tonight, Davis? Very kindly, and with a quick change. Quite well, miss. Are you sure? Your voice sounds altered in my hearing. No, miss, I am a stronger man than ever. But England is nothing to me. Miss Marion sat silent for so long a while that I believed she had done speaking to me for one time. However, she had not, for by and by she said in a distinct, clear tone, No, good friend, you must not say that England is nothing to you. It is to be much to you, yet everything to you. You have to take back to England the good name you have earned here, and the gratitude and attachment and respect you have won here. And you have to make some good English girl very happy and proud by marrying her, and I shall one day see her, I hope, and make her happier and prouder still by telling her what noble services her husband's were in South America, and what a noble friend he was to me there. Though she spoke these kind words in a cheering manner, she spoke them compassionately. I said nothing. It will appear to be another strange confession that I paced to and fro, within call, all that night, a most unhappy man, reproaching myself all the night long. You are as ignorant as any man alive. You are as obscure as any man alive. You are as poor as any man alive. You are no better than the mud under your foot. That was the way in which I went on against myself until the morning. With the day, came the day's labor. What I should have done without the labor, I don't know. We were afloat again at the usual hour, and were again making our way down the river. It was broader, and clearer of obstructions than it had been, and it seemed to flow faster. This was one of Bruce's quiet days. Mr. Portage, besides being sulky, had almost lost his voice. And we made good way, and with little noise. There was always a seaman forward on the raft, keeping a bright lookout. Suddenly, in the full heat of the day, when the children were slumbering, and the very trees and reeds appeared to be slumbering, this man that was short holds up his hand, and cries with great caution, Avast! Voices ahead! We held on against the stream as soon as we could bring her up, and the other raft followed suit. At first, Mr. Macy, Mr. Fisher, and myself could hear nothing, though both the seamen aboard of us agreed that they could hear voices and oars. After a little pause, however, we united in thinking that we could hear the sound of voices and the dip of oars. But you can hear a long way in those countries, and there was a bend of the river before us, and nothing was to be seen except such waters, and such banks as we were now in the 8th day and might, for the matter of our feelings, have been in the 80th, of having seen with anxious eyes. It was soon decided to put a man ashore, who should creep through the wood, see what was coming, and warn the rafts. The rafts in the meantime, to keep the middle of the stream. The man to be put ashore, and not to swim ashore, as the first thing could be more quickly done than the second. The raft conveying him, to get back into midstream, and to hold on along with the other, as well as it could, until signaled by the man. In case of danger, the man to shift for himself until it should be safe to take him on board again. I volunteered to be the man. We knew that the voices and oars must come up slowly against the stream, and our seamen knew, by the set of the stream, under which bank they would come. I was put ashore accordingly. The raft got off well, and I broke into the wood. Steaming hot it was, and a tearing place to get through. So much the better for me, since it was something to contend against and do. I cut off the bend of the river, at a great saving of space, came to the water's edge again, and hid myself, and waited. I could now hear the dip of the oars very distinctly. The voices had ceased. The sound came on in a regular tune, and as I lay hidden, I fancied the tune so played to be, "Christen George King! Christen George King! Christen George King!" Over and over again, all was the same, with the pauses always at the same places. I had likewise time to make up my mind, that if these were the pirates, I could and would, barring my being shot, swim off to my raft, in spite of my wound, the moment I had given the alarm, and hold my old post by Miss Marion. "Christen George King! Christen George King! Christen George King!" Coming up now, very near. I took a look at the branches about me, to see where a shower of bullets would be most likely to do me least hurt, and I took a look back at the track I had made in forcing my way in, and now I was wholly prepared, and fully ready for them. "Christen George King! Christen George King! Christen George King! Here they are!" Who were they? The barbarous pirates, scum of all nations, headed by such men as the hideous little Portuguese monkey, and the one-eyed English convict with the gash across his face, that ought to have gashed his wicked head off? The worst men in the world picked out from the worst, to do the cruelest, and most atrocious deeds that ever stained it? The howling, murdering, black flag waving, mad, and drunken crowd of devils, that had overcome us by numbers and by treachery? No. These were Englishmen in English boats, good blue jackets and red coats, marines, that I knew myself, and sailors that knew our seamen. At the helm of the first boat, Captain Carton, eager and steady. At the helm of the second boat, Captain Marion, brave and bold. At the helm of the third boat, an old seaman, with determination carved into his watchful face, like the figurehead of a ship. Every man doubly and trebly armed from head to foot. Every man lying to at his work, with a will, that had all his heart and soul in it. Every man looking out for any trace of friend or enemy, and burning to be the first, to do good or avenge evil. Every man with his face on fire when he saw me, his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.